Over his extensive career, Tracy Kidder has written some enormously popular books, including his Pulitzer Prize and National Book of the Year award-winning The Soul of a New Machine. Other bestsellers include Among School Children, Old Friends, and My Detachment. He has also written extensively about this region in his classic books, House and Hometown.
I can't believe he's here with us. Possibly his most influential book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, highlights two global health crises, tuberculosis and AIDS, and follows Dr. Paul Farmer's inspiring efforts to establish hospitals to treat and prevent the spread of both epidemics.
Tracy Kidder graduated from Harvard and studied at the University of Iowa. He has won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and the RFK Award, and many other literary prizes. His latest is Good Prose. It's now out in paperback. It's an honor to call him a friend. Tracy Kidder, welcome back to the program. Delight. It's wonderful to be in your area.
Thanks.
Your backyard.
Oh, it's nice to be here. I mean, I'm glad to have you here in my area.
You usually come to us, so it's nice to come to you in this regard.
Here in the Pioneer Valley.
We were so excited that you were going to be here, as Alan mentioned, because you have written so much about this area and about this region. And it's fascinating. Did you think that it would be as ripe for you to write about and to be a place for you to investigate as much as it's become?
I don't think it... Mark Singer, the writer, once accused me of using the protractor method of choosing my subjects. You know, for a while I was getting closer and closer to home. I did it because it seemed to me, you know, it was a lot more convenient and sort of, you know, with a young family and not very much money.
So you didn't want to go far.
I didn't. I didn't for a long time, but I didn't feel like I had to. You know, everything is pretty much here. And everything would be pretty much there, wherever there is, you know, I think, at least in the United States, with obvious differences. Just about the time when I'd gotten too old to feel comfortable traveling, you know, too addicted to my comforts and so on, I set out with Paul Farmer, you know, and went all around the world with him, and then started going to Africa, and I don't know quite why I did that. I suppose it would be nice to come back home again, but I haven't done that yet.
So tell us about Paul Farmer a little bit.
Well, I mean, he goes on. You know, I think the earthquake in Haiti was an enormous... it was an enormous blow to the Haitians, and for him, a sort of call to action. I was recently in Haiti, and I saw the hospital that they had built using some of the money that they had been given in donations after that. It was a wonder. It was really quite spectacular. Great, huge hospital, a brand new, not an architectural gem, just really well built, just designed to be a really good hospital, not an ego. Than the one where a couple of my grandchildren were at Beth Israel in Boston. I was astonished. And, you know, when I was there, about 15 Haitian medical students were just beginning their residencies. As you might expect, tons of really eminent American doctors come there to help teach the Haitian doctors, but it is a Haitian operation. And the other thing I noticed about this place was the warmth of the staff toward each other really seemed unusual to me. I mean, people who hadn't seen each other for 8 hours had to give each other three or four hugs and kisses, you know. It was just, it was really very nice and hopeful in a, you know, in a country where hope is still a pretty frail commodity.
Are the American people keeping up? In other words, when the great crisis happened and JT asked for our help, and we put on some things and we raised, what, $50,000 or something like that. Everybody wanted to do something, but is it hard to maintain that?
I think so. You know, I haven't kept track, Alan, but my impression is that a lot of that money that was promised to Haiti still hasn't arrived. I don't know if that's the truth, but that was the truth a while back. Yeah. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, of course. I mean, look what's happening all over the world. Every single day there's something else to tug at your heartstrings. Haiti, though, is, I think, tremendously important. I mean, it's more than symbolic, of course, because there are millions of people there but for this country, it's a terribly important place, I think, in part because we are in our history, not those of us living today, by and large, have been responsible. Our history is responsible for a lot of the problems there, a lot of the suffering.
I'm going to ask you a question you're not going to like, but I'll ask it to you anyway. When you get a Pulitzer Prize, can you remember the moment you got it?
Yeah, I do.
And how did it feel?
Actually, I was told a couple of weeks beforehand that I was going to get one, and I felt pretty good. But I also felt kind of frightened and exposed. I was only in my 30s, and I had all my writer friends and I were strictly for, and suddenly.
You mean hungry?
Yeah, right. Well, not hungry, not literally, but you know. And I don't think I handled it very well. In fact, I know I didn't.
What did you do?
I drank a lot.
Oh, I see. So
And rested on my laurels, you know. Yeah. With a bottle in my my lips.
But that didn't last long. I mean, the follow-up book was very successful.
Right.
And I mean, you rebounded quickly.
No, actually, it took me quite a while, Joe. I had to find. I tried out a whole bunch of different subjects because I knew that I had a chance to write for a living, and I didn't want to blow it. And I think, you know, and the fear of wasting a year on some
a
project that didn't pan out, I wasted a year or more, as I recall, trying to find a subject that wouldn't, you know.
Here we are in this place with all these colleges and universities and a lot of English majors, which Garrison Keillor, of course, always makes fun of. The question to you is, can you teach somebody how to write?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yes. I guess the analogy that I like that I've heard from, I think I heard this from my friend Stuart Dybeck, a wonderful writer, is that, you know, if you wanted to learn to play a musical instrument, you'd get some lessons, probably.
Except, if I can argue with you.
Please.
People are born with it or not. I'm convinced of that. I played banjo for 14 years. I had a friend. He said, can I see that for a minute? He played better than I did after an hour.
Right.
I mean, some people can do it.
I'm sure that's true. And I think that's probably true of writing as well. But the question of whether you can learn to write well or write better than you do.
Write better, yeah.
And even to write well, I do think most people can do that. Whether you can write, I mean, most people, I don't care how hard they work, are not going to be Leo Tolstoy.
No.
You know, but that's, I guess that's not the question. I mean, you can learn a lot about how to write and how to read in an academic institution if you have a good teacher.
I love asking this question. And
Where you read good prose, by the way.
Yeah, so your yearbook, Good Prose, with your editor.
With my editor, Richard Todd, yeah.
Yeah. It is... when you look back, you won the Pulitzer Prize, so you always have that Pulitzer Prize winning author, Tracy Kidder. So you won it for Soul of a New Machine. Do you look at that now as some of your finest work?
No. I don't. I try not to look back at any of it, tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Only two things can happen if I go back and reread things that I've written, that are published. Either I think, oh, God, how did I let that sentence go to press? Or I think it's almost worse. Did I used to write that well?
Mm.
but I don't know. You know, I used to think that I used to kind of disown the Soul of a New Machine. I don't know why exactly, thinking, well, I could do better work. And I think I have, actually. But I haven't looked at the book for so long that I wouldn't really
okay,
know.
Okay, so here's a brilliant question for me. Ready? Who's your favorite author?
Wow. In some ways, it's my editor, Richard Todd, although he hasn't written very much. I have just my tastes are too eclectic to answer that question easily. One of my favorite poets lives right near here, which Richard Wilbur, a great poet, one of the great living poets in the world, I think. I've always loved nonfiction John McPhee. I'm pretty prejudiced, but I think the short story writer Stuart Dybeck is just aces. I could go on and on, but if I had to choose just one writer,
if there was a gun at your head,
Shakespeare, of course.
Well, yeah. Do you think, given what you write and how you go about a project, does time work for you in the sense of you're not a book a year person, and that seems to be reflected in the final product.
It takes me 3 years, as a rule, has taken me 3 years to research and write a book. I have to do a lot of research.
Hmm.
The time is a great luxury. Most writers, you know, have to file, if they don't have to file daily stories, they have to file monthly or, you know, every right. few months. I remember when I was writing a lot of articles for the Atlantic Monthly, mostly. I mean, it was really harrowing because it would take me all this time to do the research and, and then to try to write something good. And, you know, and I was only getting paid a couple $1,000 an article. My wife hadn't been able to help. We've probably been on food stamps, so you know.
Do you look at it though when you set out on a project, and you say, as you say, you fish around, you say, okay, this won't work. I don't want to invest this much time in something that isn't going to be fruitful. But once you have the idea and you're living in the book and you're doing the research and you're, because there's not just the writing process, there's the actual thinking it through, right?
I do that a lot with Richard Todd. And of late, it's gotten silly, poor guy. I mean, I'm on the phone with him pretty much every day discussing what I've been finding out, what I've been writing. I haven't been able to limit it very well. But I get quite anxious about it all. It's nice to have someone to talk to. I hope I'm not using him as a big kidney.
Do you think most authors have that relationship with the with their editor,
no.
the relationship that you do?
I know of no other writers who have that relationship, although, which isn't to say that there aren't any, but it's been pretty special. And that's one of the reasons why good prose was so much fun to write, ultimately, because I got to relive a lot of...
And you wrote it with him.
I wrote it with him.
Both, you get both perspectives.
It was really interesting. I got to criticize him for a change, which was fun. But more than that, you know, I got to kind of go back and relive what's clearly been one of the best parts of my life, one of the most amusing, and obviously rewarding. It's really, yeah, I think it's a pretty unusual relationship, and I've been very grateful for it.
Speaking of which, Joe and I have some disagreements. One of them is that he prepares for everything.
And, I and don't you believe, don't, Alan?
No.
I'm listening to you on WAMC. I would have...
I don't believe in preparation, you know. I believe in intuition.
Uh-huh.
So
inspiration.
Yeah, inspiration, you know. You ask a question and that. But he's so good at it. Joe's so good at it. And people hear all the time and say, how does he do that? And look at the hours he puts into this. And he reads every book and... all the rest. So preparation's a big part of your life.
To write, sure, it's a huge part of my life. I mean, I have to go and do all this research and then come back.
But there comes that moment where you put your fingers on the keyboard, right? And then something happens, no matter what, how much you've prepared. Is there an avoidance in preparation for doing the actual writing?
I'm pretty good at not doing that. I mean, I do take my notes and transcribe them onto a computer now. I didn't used to do that. I try not to spend too much time preparing. I have friends who are stunningly ingenious in avoiding getting down to writing.
Yeah.
But I won't name my poor friend. Everyone,
ah, come on.
A great writer named Jonathan Hart, but boy, is he good at avoiding writing.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Anyway, but I try not to do that. I understand why people do it, but it just nags at me, you know, and it keeps me up at night, so
because,
it's easier just to go to work.
Because the moment that you put your fingers on the keyboard, they sort of take on a certain magic of their own, right, no matter how much preparation.
It can be pretty malign magic. But yeah, you hope.
So just give us a timeline. So when you were writing House, how long did that book take you?
3 years, I think, roughly. Wow.
And the actual, so from the time that the project was going on and you were watching it to the time the book came out, what was that timeline?
I think it was 3 years. Oh, the book came out probably more on the order of four, because I'm not absolutely sure, but it used to take 9 months for a book to be published from the
right.
time it was accepted.
Right.
Why it was 9 months, I don't know. It seems
well,
odd.
Very, yeah.
I know.
Very,
yeah.
Gestation.
But ridiculous.
Okay.
And now I think publishers can bring out books much faster, but they have these publishing seasons and they have
right.
tons of things to do. who knows anymore.
But when you were actually in the house, like, when were they doing that? I mean, was that you were writing as that project was going on?
And not much. I was mostly taking notes and just following these guys around. There were three parties for me to be. There were the incipient homeowners and the architect and the builders, and I spent time with all of them. I like to say, the story was a menage a trois without sexual connotations.
And who did you like the most? In other words, did you like the homeowners, or were they the naive group? And were the builders? I mean, in other words,
I liked them all. I mean, honestly, Alan,
you like all your children.
Well, I had to. I felt that was part of my job, not to be judgmental, but just try to understand. The homeowners were not naive; they were very sophisticated and they were tough, but fair. I thought the carpenters were delightful. The architect was fascinating. He's now a great big shot. Great big, I say, 6'6", but his name is William Rawn. He did the Ozawa Hall.
Oh, yeah.
He did the...
What a building.
He did Williams College's, Performing Arts Center. Tons of stuff. Done huge parts.
62.
Campuses
Center, yeah.
In Boston and so on. But this was his first commission all on his own, that house. Sadly, the man of the house, Jonathan Swain, died really prematurely. Right over here, right down the road. Anyway,
I'm shocked at your remark about being non-judgmental.
I try not to be judgmental. Of course, I am. But
I find it the greatest joy in life
to be judgmental. Yeah. But Alan, that in my private life, I'm probably as judgmental. Well, I might be half as judgmental as you are, but that's not my working life, you know.
No, I hear you. You're a pro.
I try to be.
Yeah.
When you are you better now? Not better, but I mean, as far as understanding, getting a sense of a project, of saying, okay, this is something that not only do I want to do, but that I can really, that will challenge me in a new way.
I wish I were, Joe. You know, I wish I knew how to find a new project that was surefire, but I don't have an algorithm for that. There are very few things that I've abandoned, though. There's usually something. It's usually not what I thought it was. That's the other thing, is that it's very hard to know ahead of time whether something's going to be. A poet friend of mine, Robert Bagg, used the term once, gave me this term, literogenic. Whether something is going to, you know.
That's a great term.
So I don't know.
Well, I am, we're just delighted that you're here. And thank you so much for being with us. Tracy Kidder's latest book is Good Prose. It's out in paperback. You can find more about his work at Tracy Kidder.
Good to see you.
You're listening to the Roundtable's live broadcast from the Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Massachusetts. Coming up next, music from Yidstock. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.